after Haber had placed all these people that Hitler told him to throw out, I think he committed suicide. I don't know, but he told me that. He said he had a heart attack in Basel on the train, but I think he committed suicide. The gutter glimmering, you know. Mm. Now, another, there's so many things he told me. For example, one day, he was there, the stock market crashed, September 20th, when it was 1929. And he said, Dr. Allier, that is the end of democracy in Germany. He says, our industrialists will no longer give us money that can proceed as your industry does. And spending money so lavishly on research is what he was referring to. I'll tell you in a minute. Then he said, you have failed, and we will fail to have the money to carry on our research. And then one day, he had this letter from somebody in Florida. It was a phosphorus furnace. The first electric phosphorus furnace, they take the apatite rock down there and they make phosphorus from it in an electric furnace. In 1930, it was all written up in the journals. But the first one, they had an accident and it burned out. And here was a letter from one of his colleagues, and it wrote, Geheimer, we've got the phosphorus burning, but we had an accident. 1 hour after it started, it froze. And it's completely no good. But never mind, Herr Geheimrat, today we're starting to build another one, and maybe in 6 months I'll have the answer. This was all written up later on. And he said, that's the way with you Americans, because the industrialists are always laughing, I tell them. That is how you cut all and any of it out after you get home. I wouldn't be the slightest bit offended. It wasn't too much I could tell you about out at Minnesota. It was an interesting scientific experience, and they were good living. So McDougall was the best physical chemist there. He was a thermodynamist. McDougall and Lind was a scientist. Yeah, there were some good, and there were good organic chemists too. Smith, one of the Smiths, his laboratory is named out. I forget what his first name was, but
I wonder if we could also ask you who else worked at Berlin with you. In addition to you worked with Haber, who else was there?
Well, Henry Eyring was working with Polanyi. Mm-hmm. Henry Eyring was with Polanyi. The fellow worked with Freundlich. I can't think of his name now. Everyone, Sam Kistler. Now, never mind. I thought of it. Sam Kistler. Worked with Freud. He was very interesting. He later ended up teaching at Utah with Eyring. Laudenberg was there. Paul Hartek. In fact, I worked in the same room as Paul Hartek. Paul Hartek later became, I think it was in Hamburg, the institute in Hamburg. He was the one that warned Hitler about the hydrogen bomb. He was one of the ones that Haber placed. He placed him up at Rensselaer, and he was one of the big men up at Rensselaer from 1930 until he died about 2 years ago. There are a lot of important people there. And at these meetings, it was a fabulous collection of people. You see, Planck, these Nobel Prize men that were talking one night were rating people, and they rated Bohr was there. I'll tell you about that later. That's a longer story.
Well, there's no reason not to tell it now.
This is another entirely different story. It takes place in 1947-48 at 120 Prospect Avenue, not street, you know, in the apartment there. This is where the computer was conceived. Did you know that? Yeah. Now, the Institute of Study of Man's Writing the History, it says there's no question that my account is correct. Now, what happened was this. It's unbelievable the things that happened to Allier, but I think it's partly because I treat these great people like human beings, and they crave it because people, they can't get near people, you see. And they realize that I admire them and know that they're here and there, you see. One night in that apartment, everyone out there was Bob Robertson and his wife. Now, Bob was one of the top mathematicians here at Princeton, you see, H.B. Robertson. In fact, Bright Wilson is mentioned about this, he studied with H.B. Robertson. Bob one night said to me, come over to the house tonight. We're going to have the Nobel Prize from the Institute over here. You and I. So I went. Now, why did he ask me? Well, because we played chess. There's no scientific bond between us. We knew this. Actually, he did ask me one question I think was very important, but I won't tell about it. And I gave the right answer, I think. But he came and he said, come on over, Hubert. Well, I went over. Well, the next week he says, come back again, we do it every Tuesday. And I said to him, Bob, you don't want me. And then he said something that people who know Hubert Allen know I must have been lying, but he did say it. He said, sure, we want you. You keep your mouth shut. Couldn't hear anyone say that about Hubert Allen. He said, you sit off in the corner by there, as long as you don't say anything. He says, we don't know what you're thinking, brightest thoughts at us. Come on back. So every night, six times in 57 and six times in 58, I went back there and sat in the corner and listened to them. In fact, the only conversation I remember was once with Jonathan Neumann, the brightest one of all of them. I had been on with Burgess Meredith a couple of times, and I exploded a dust can. Mm-hmm. And Jonathan Neumann came to me and said, Hubert, I saw you on television Wednesday. He said, so you put out a hand you can't without a flower. So what are you going to do next week? Well, now he was an authority in probability. And I said, Johnny, I said, you're the world authority in probability. If you can't calculate what I'm probably going to do, you're losing your grip. Good show, old man. We're going to listen to you. Well, you know, up until about 3 years ago, I used to think that the only reason they tolerated me was I was Bob Robertson's friend and kept my mouth shut. But the more I thought, I only read something, when people excel in one field, they have a reverence for people in other fields. And now it's so many downs, and they all saw me on that television. They all mentioned, we all saw you on television. They said, Bob Allier is going to be on television. They all saw me. And I think they saw here was a guy, his interpreting to the public in a way that we're not able to. Despite all I learned, we can't communicate to the public the way this guy is. Mm-hmm. And I think they tolerated me for that, but also because I kept my mouth shut, you see. Well, two occasions, I should have recorded all this. Two occasions. One, they were discussing, I should say this, incidentally. People take offense out of some of them. One night they're discussing, are there any first-class scientists, like Leonardo da Vinci or Galileo or Newton? And they turned to Niels Bohr, was always there with Wheeler. Wigner was always there. Schrödinger and Heisenberg would come through. Rabi, von Laue, Polanyi. Trying to think who other the great... Fred Hoyle. Of course, Robertson was always there in this house. It's unbelievable procession. Dirac. In fact, Dirac met Wigner's sister in our house in Nyarder. So they're all very, very close. And Hubert Allier, who wasn't anything, and I'm saying it, and I mean it, but they realized that I kept my mouth shut. and they met seven times in 47, seven times in 48. John Wheeler didn't come until 48, so he was in that session. I believe that that's right, because the second story I'm going to tell you is in 48. I don't know who was at the... It's a good thing I don't know, so I can't say, well, this is the answer. One night, was there a first-class scientist? They said, Niels, so this must have been 48. They said, Niels, because he used to come every spring from then on to work with Wheeler, you know. I said, Niels, we'll say you're fifth class. They say all the rest of us are sixth class. The American Light said, how do you get a 28th class? Which I was. But there wasn't anybody fourth class. There wasn't anybody third class. There wasn't anybody second class. They said, Einstein is only one and a half class. There's something greater than Einstein. Einstein doesn't quite make it unless his unified field theory is proven during his lifetime. In fact, it's being proved now, presumably. Now, remember, Einstein was their enemy. He never came to them. Hmm. He was a classical mechanics. They were quantum mechanics. They didn't speak the same language, you see. He must have been very unhappy in that situation to be surrounded by so many brilliant quantum mechanics people. And he and just a few others. And so he never came. And this may have been in what they have said. I think today they would have placed the two of them as number two, at number one, you see. But greater than Einstein, and I always say in an audience of 500, there's not more than a dozen I've probably ever heard of this man, is who? Max Planck. Mm-hmm. How many knew Max Planck? I'll say 12, I thought it was. There's never more than 30 in 500 that ever heard of Max Planck. Mm-hmm. And yet, why did they say Max Planck was greater than Einstein in his contribution to science? Not in his contribution to the world. Einstein did an awful lot more than... In fact, the funny thing is that Planck discovered the basis of all of modern physics and then didn't know what to do with it. Planck's H is the basis of all of modern physics. And that was 1901. 4 years later, Einstein came along in 1905, published five different papers in five different fields, any one of which would have won the Nobel Prize, all based on Planck's constant. Mm-hmm. So as I say, jokingly, he had a Planck to stand on. I mean, there was MC Square, there was the beam of light, the laser beam that he predicted, the one that every time a photon was absorbed, an electron was ejected, they got a Nobel Prize for that one. The photon chain reactions that every time one atom, well, that was interesting too. When Einstein got a Nobel Prize in 1921, I saw Madame Curie and Einstein get honorary degrees in Princeton, in Alexander Hall. And Taylor, who was working on chain reactions and so, and with Bodenstein, went up to Einstein and said something to him. And after, I said, what did you say to him? Now, this was 1921 or 2, probably. And Einstein had done this in 1905. And they said to Einstein, I said, well, what's new about the Einstein photochemical law? Einstein said, oh, ich hab das ganz vergessen. Forgotten it completely. What was I telling you about now? The Planck constant was the basis of all of modern. Now, the interesting thing is, the Planck constant tells us of the discreteness. You have not only discrete particles called atoms, you have discrete particles of light waves called photons, you have discrete particles of electricity called electrons. Oh, and I have to tell you, now the year I was there, every Saturday, Einstein appeared at Planck's house with his violin under one arm and his wife under another. And they sat down and played music from 3 in the afternoon till 10 at night with an hour out for dinner. Those great men didn't find that music intruded on their science. It made them dream. And of course, when I'm talking to young people, I say that you can be a great technician if you're a great scientist, but you can never be a great scientist unless you dream. And these men didn't find that music intruded on their dream. It made them dream, you see. So here were the two greatest scientists of the world, of a century, spending all those hours playing music. And Planck, in fact, intended originally to be a professional pianist. His father wanted to be one thing, he wanted to be another. And when he graduated from the university in Berlin, his father paid $50 matriculation fee, which was a lot of money then, both to the Conservatory of Music and the Physics Institute. And Planck attended lectures for 6 weeks to both of them, and then decided to become a physicist. Now, the interesting speculation I have, I always am interested in serendipity and lecture about serendipity, is Einstein played a continuous instrument, the violin. Planck played a discrete instrument, the piano. If it had been the other way around, would Einstein have thought of Planck's constant, discrete H, and Planck going to town with Einstein's H? I don't know. If it is, to try to go back, I haven't had time to do it, but to go back into the Planck work and see how the thought came to him. But the thought was that he never really discovered how important it was what he said. Later, you know, the institute was called the Planck Institute, this kind of moment that it was changed to the Planck Institute. And Planck would come to those meetings, too. And now that's the first of this meeting. Now, the second meeting in 48 was even more famous. This was the conception of the computer. Mm-hmm. Now, remember, the people who tell you the history of the computer, for example, they all say it began at the University of Pennsylvania, you see, with the maniac, you see. We're talking about the conception of it and not the building of it. Actually, back in the 17th century, somebody invented something that was probably very close to a mechanical computer, and the Black Plague killed him. They never did find his notes. Mm-hmm. And then early in about 1810 or 20, the University of Pennsylvania, they made a mechanical computer counter or something. And around 1880, an even more complex one. But this is the modern computer. Mm-hmm. And this is how it was conceived. And I was impressed with that. It was one of these meetings. Oh, now what I was going to say, why all these people were here was that if Dirac were going to lecture at Berkeley for 6 months, he'd land in New York, he'd immediately come down here. Mm-hmm. For a couple of weeks. He had a standing invitation. And so there are all these notables always in and out of here. And Tuesday night, Robertson's night, and they all come over there. That's why they were there. And that's why it was a constant. There was always somewhere around 8 of them or 10 of them. And they're different, depending on who happened to be passing through, you see. But this one night, what they would do, two would talk, and then suddenly four would talk, and then suddenly the whole one, within 15 minutes from the time they arrived, they'd all be talking about one topic the rest of the evening. They took one topic and talked the whole evening. And I can kill myself for not being a Boswell in the recording always. Mm-hmm. But anyway, this one night, they said, we've got to invent a mechanical brain. They said, things have got so complex now that by the time you have gone through 4 years of high school and 4 years of college, 3 or 4 years getting your PhD, a couple of years of postdoc, and then the calculations are so complex, you'd be 35 before you could discover anything worth a Nobel Prize. And then they went, this is why I can shoot myself not doing it. They went around the group, and each one recalled how old was he when the idea they gave him a Nobel Prize came to him. And everyone had been younger than 22 or younger. Hmm. They might not have gotten it until they were 31, I think one said. Well, I didn't get it until I was 31, but the idea came when I was 22, you see, which is interesting. Johnny von Neumann was very excited about it, you see. But they said, you can't really make a mechanical computer. It has to have 20,000 diodes. The bulbs that had only diodes, they didn't have pentodes, they didn't have tristodes, they didn't have chips that would do the work at 20,000. And a diode burns out every 2 months. By the time you've calculated with 20,000 diodes, something will burn out and you can get a wrong answer. In fact, over here at the UNIVAC, when they first began, they always ran the known, and then the unknown, and then the original known, to make sure the original and the other one were the same while they're doing the unknown, and nothing had burned out, you see. So now here's a calculation that it would take me a month to come up with the wrong answer. These great minds began, and Wigner and von Neumann came up with the right answer. One of them said, I had 6.5 seconds. The other said, I had 7 seconds. A bulb would burn out in 7 seconds. Boy, he said, that's a long while. You get a lot of answers in 7 seconds. And the rest of the night, that's all they talk about. How would this machine be made? Would it be multiple choice or binary choice? What kind of a mathematical system would you have, and so on? And at 10:30, Evelyn and Angeline used to come in and pass drinks around to people. At 10:45, they all religiously, it was like that, 15 minutes for drinks and then leave. At 10:45, they all left, all except von Neumann. And I was sitting over in the corner listening. I always stayed on afterwards and talked with Bob for 10 minutes while he briefed me on what they'd said. And this time, von Neumann was so excited. Now remember, he was the world authority on probability and so on. As he got to the door, he turned to Bob, and this was the moment of conception of the modern computer. He says, by God, I'm going to work on that. And out the door he went. Well, the Institute people fill me in what happened. He says, right after that, the war came. And von Neumann insisted that all of Los Alamos work be computerized. All they had was punch cards, you see. So he went out to Los Alamos, and they set up a mechanical card sorter. They called it the Maniac. And he supervised the building of the Maniac. And then pretty soon they got the tubes working better, and they got then they went down to the University of Pennsylvania and built the ENIVAC, and the ENIVAC in Pennsylvania and up at MIT. But the guy there at the Institute said, you know, they didn't really use the ENIVAC much for the war. It wasn't until toward the end of the war that it was really operating. It didn't really have much of a chance in winning the war, but it then was on sound ground. And then the UNIVAC he did much later. I think it was until 1960 that Johnny von Neumann did that. May have been 1950, but I think it was 1960. So that was the birth of the computer.
Well, this must have been very intriguing gatherings.
Unbelievable, you know, that I can do things like that.
We should get on to your
Go ahead.
Your lecturing career and things, but I just wanted to ask...
By the way, I have something I'm going to make a bound book and give you. I've given over 5,000 lectures away from Princeton, and eventually I'll probably do it this summer. I'll make a bound book that I'll give you. I might as well take the whole thing here. I have a bound book I'll give you that will, it won't be that thick, it'll be something like this. Here is, for example, 1960. I can't find the other one. The other one's about twice as thick as that, of the five. And it tells everywhere I did. It's unbelievable. A human being could have laughed at that one. And they were long, like they took an hour and a half, 2 hours to set up, and 2 hours to give, and an hour to lay away. Physically, I don't know how I do it. But you can see where I've been. One day I'll be there, and the next day I'll be in Denver, the next day I'll be in Philadelphia. And I always came back to Princeton, and in Princeton, Wednesday night, I had 3 classes that went from 7 at night until midnight. 17 in my non-science course. 17 where I had little seats and had blackboard, and they all began with an exam, a 7-minute exam, and then we graded the exam. Since you had the honor system, they graded it themselves in review of the week, and then they had to read an outside book, and they would discuss that for the last 15 minutes or so. Mm-hmm. And then they would all adjourn into the next room where dear little Evelyn used to make, when there were only about 30 of them, used to make cupcakes and things for them all. And then later, when they got to be about 60, there'd be about 15 to 20 in each of the three groups. They'd come from 7 to 8:30, then from 8:30 when they arrived from till 10, and then from 10 until 11:30, but they'd stay until midnight, and out they'd go. And all 50 or 55 had come into my house that night, and we'd have a roaring fire. I had English with J. Duncan Spaeth, and in fact, I have a lovely letter here. They said I was the only scientist he ever taught or ever understood literature. And we used to be in Buzz Kyler's house, where the Hessians quartered during the Revolutionary War, and he used to have a roaring fire there, and we used to gather around there discussing Shakespeare. And I said, if I ever grow up to be a teacher like him, I'm going to have the same thing. And so I would always have a roaring in the wintertime, a roaring fire in the fireplace. And the kids who wanted to pretend they're men were really, they just loved that touch of home. Mm-hmm. And at reunion, they'll bring their wives up. Darling, this is Professor. Oh, my husband told me how he used to come over to your house where you had a fireplace and you studied chemistry. And I always hoped a wealthy man would give money. So poor, it used to cost us a couple of $100s, and that was an awful lot of money when you were making maybe about $3,000 a year, just to feed the people. They had, because they had cider. Today it's a problem because of the beer, but they couldn't drink beer in those days. They used to have cider, and I used to get, I don't know, 6 dozen donuts. Everybody had either 2 or 3 donuts, and it was just wonderful. Those last 30 minutes is when I really learned about my teaching with the students, because they let their hair down and start talking, well, why did you do that? We had that in high school. And I'll never forget with I.A. Gay. And they used to, of course, argue about girls and sex and about God. So I'll never forget this huge, burly football player bending over a tiny little fellow on a couch, shaking his head at this little hand, little fellow. I tell you, there is a God. Little kid, scared. All right. But that was when I really got to know the people, and the people got to know me. And that is the way for a teacher to get to know the kids. You knew whether they weren't afraid to pull punches and say, oh, would you? We had that in high school. I really didn't understand that very well, you know, and so on.
When was it you began to teach general chemistry, introductory chemistry?
From the very beginning. Yeah. Because Foster, who was a teacher, didn't do very much research. He was doing research on arsenic and so on. I ought to tell you that about Dr. McKay. He was an arsenic authority. Mm-hmm. Everything was arsenic. And no matter what, I'm sure when Edgar Farr Smith lectured there, and I heard him in 1921 I'm sure at the end of the lecture, Leroy would have said, by the by, he always said, by the by, Dr. Smith, can you tell me anything new about arsenic? He would always know what the lecture was about, and how would arsenic affect that reaction? He knew he was going to answer. I'm sure he's up in heaven eating arsenic by the ton. Well, excuse me, now, where were you coming back to?
You mentioned Foster.
Foster was his student. He was a good, sound, gentlemanly teacher. But he took sick, and I was assisting in the lab, and then about 2 years into it, Foster suddenly took sick, and I got a call from Hugh Taylor. He says, Professor Foster's in the hospital. Will you give the lecture the rest of the all next term, beginning next Monday? And so I suddenly catapulted into it, and found I loved to teach, just loved to teach, and gave up most of the research. I did very little research. I'm really an inventor rather than a chemist. I've invented a lot of things. I ought to tell you, I invented the automatic slide changer. I ought to tell you that. I invented an awful lot of things. And my top stuff that I have, it's really invention. And the research that I did was good because the inventions of the machines I used that I invented. I haven't even mentioned that research. Very excellent research I did in the 1950s. Actually, it was promoted me to full professor because it was the best thing that had been done in Princeton that year. There's no question of that. The General Electric, all these people had me come and give that paper. And General, I never published it. So I sent it to anybody who wants it, but he never got around to publish it. I was going off to Thailand or something. He never got around to publish. It was a PhD thesis, so it was all, it's in the library and so on. Mm-hmm. But the Naval Ordnance, Bell Telephone, Oak Ridge, all had me come and give it. In fact, even a few years ago, I was at 3M and gave it again. They wanted to hear more of what I had done on surface potentials. And I took the one of the companies, which one? I took one look at it, and I said, the trouble with you is you had too much money. They had spent $10,000 just for the instrument and 4 years of a man's salary, and he still hadn't gotten the results. I said, the minute we saw how you got the results, I said, well, the trouble is you should have put a fishing pole in the man's hand and go out fish. I haven't right. It's an example of directed research in a university against monthly reports of accomplishment in industry. Mm-hmm. This guy kept turning out these monthly reports. He was doing this surface. I had Unum Molecular Films and bombarding with free radicals and measuring how fast the reactions were. And it was they would have to vibrate something, and they were putting things around. All I did was, after thinking a lot, I had two guys getting a PhD. They said, we got to get a PhD. I said, listen, you can't take measurements until we've eliminated the stray fields. Once you get that, in 2 weeks you get measurements. And finally, when they got it, they got tons of measurements in a month. All I did was, here was this thing vibrating, and you have to vibrate it, so you have to have something mechanical to vibrate, and then you're going to measure tiny little micro voltages here. Well, they surrounded it and shielded it like this. What I did was take a long quartz fiber, 6 feet long, and have a vibrating machine way up there, and borrowed my father-in-law's $20 radio to use for the vibrator. My machine didn't cost more than $30, and the General Electric must have spent, I'm sure they must have spent $50,000 on it, and couldn't get the results I get. In fact, they said, took measurements every month, he was saying how he's getting it. Then they took the graphs of July and they put them over January, and they didn't agree. I said, of course they didn't. I'll tell you why. I said, the humidity didn't have air conditioning. The humidity didn't. He said, that's just the reason, but it took us 5 more months to find it out. He said, well, he didn't send them fishing. But here was my reputation and the PhD of these kids was hanging in the balance. And I was determined not to publish until I had good results, you see. Whereas in industry, you have to prove that you were earning your keep. Yeah. Very interesting contrast. That isn't true in all industries. I mean, the industry has become enlightened today, but in those days, you have to put up, or they shifted you to some other thing. That's what they said in Merlin Hospital. I could sell it from, you know, they would say, you're a lucky doctor. You say, no, in the university, that whenever it's exciting, you can get more people to work with you and more money to work on it. With us, whenever it begins to get exciting and pay off, they take us off and put us on something else that's going to pay off. So we never can continue right to the very end and have the final satisfaction that you get in university research. Yeah. Not always true, but...
Who were the two students you mentioned? Do you recall their names?
Yeah. Judd Ehrig at the University of... the one that did it was Brian Mead. He went to work with a DuPont company and did rather well. I think he was one of their representatives in Australia for a while. He probably retired by now. Judd Ehrig, I'll see when I go to Hawaii in August. He's a professor there in Hawaii. Mm-hmm. I sent him there. Mm-hmm. Told him, don't stay more than 2 years, or you'll stay all the rest of your life.
I did.